Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, award-winning filmmaker Stanley Nelson, lived in Harlem during the height of the crack epidemic and the so-called war on drugs. Crack transformed New York City and cities across the country. Stanley Nelson's latest documentary, Crack, Cocaine, Corruption, and Conspiracy, exposes how the epidemic decimated black and brown communities. He says he decided to make this documentary because he feels strongly that the impact of the crack era has not been fully scrutinized. Crack fueled racial and economic inequality, government corruption at the highest levels, hyper-aggressive policing, and mass incarceration. Locking people away became the solution to a deadly public health crisis. Mandatory minimum sentencing laws forced drug offenders to face lifetime sentences for minor infractions. The media also played a major role in creating hysteria around the epidemic with racist coverage of black and brown people. Decades later, the destruction of the epidemic on people's lives, families, and communities is still deeply felt, and we meet many of these people in the film. Here is a trailer for the new Netflix documentary, Crack, Cocaine, Corruption, and Conspiracy.
In the 80s, there was a lifestyle of celebration, and coke was part of that lifestyle.
It was the glitzy drug.
When crack came along, it changed everything about the black community, and it changed everything about America.
It was like the gold rush. There was people coming from all over to buy this wonder drug.
The drug so powerful, it will make you sell the clothes off your back.
The reporting played right into all of these stereotypes and this narrative.
But it's like that, and that's the way it is.
You must be intolerant of drug use and drug sellers.
You got a war on drugs. Is it not a war on the people that are supplying the drugs? Or is it only a war on the victims of the drug war?
Just say no.
It felt extraordinarily hypocritical. This was happening at a time when the U.S. government was turning a blind eye to cocaine smuggling.
Our goal was to defeat communism in Central America. And if that meant drugs got in and the youth of America used them, well, that was the way it was going to be.
We knew that they were in on it. We knew that they were dealing on the side.
What would you steal?
Money and drugs and guns, whatever was there.
That was kind of like chemical warfare on black communities.
Don't take my mother, please.
It's a story that has to be told.
That is the trailer for the new Netflix documentary, Crack, Cocaine, Corruption, and Conspiracy, and you can watch it now on Netflix. The United States has spent nearly $1 trillion on the so-called war on drugs. Since 1980, the prison population has exploded from 300,000 to more than 2 million today. And now we are joined by Stanley Nelson, an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker and founder of Firelight Media. That's a nonprofit production company. Stanley is a MacArthur Genius Fellow, and in 2013, he received the National Medal in the Humanities from President Obama. His films include Freedom Riders, Freedom Summer, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, and The Murder of Emmett Till. His latest documentary is Crack, Cocaine, Corruption, and Conspiracy. Hi, Stanley. Thanks so much for joining us, and welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. You know, Stanley, when we learned about your film and watched the trailer, it was just so hard to hear that little boy say, "Don't take my mother."
Yeah, I mean, that's an incredible scene, you know. It's incredible with the audio, but with the visual, you know, of him actually begging the police not to arrest his mother. You know, it's just heartbreaking. And it comes out of a whole section on the film where we talk about the war on drugs and the war on crack really took a huge toll on black and Latinx women.
Yeah, I really appreciated that section. Just really looking at how the media contributed to that, that whole notion of crack babies, which got so much attention, and learning that it was based on a shoddy piece of writing, one article, and we'll talk about that later in the film. But I just wanted to ask you, I read the statement that you made for this film, and you said one of the reasons why you decided to make this is because you feel very strongly that the impact of this era has not been fully scrutinized.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, you know, we've come to look at it, you know, we all know the term crackheads and crack mamas and crack holes and all those things, but we don't really kind of know what happened, and that, you know, what it led to that still reverberates today, you know, the war on drugs and the militarizing of police and, you know, the massive buildup of police forces that we saw in this summer when George Floyd was murdered and you know, and the marches and people confronting police in full body armor and automatic weapons and tanks and all those kind of things. You know, and I think in so many ways we're searching for how we got here. You know, you know, this country searching for how we got here. And this is one of the ways that we got here.
You have experience with this because you lived in Harlem during the 1980s, right in the middle of the crack epidemic. Tell us what you remember about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that my memories of it is just horrific. And you know, anybody that was around in New York or L.A. or Washington or, you know, any major city and in some instances, you know, small towns will remember that era because it was something that came out of nowhere, it seemed. And all of a sudden, you know, people were dealing crack on the streets and, you know, all over the place. People were smoking crack, you know, on the streets and all over the place. You know, you couldn't leave your car, you know, or somebody would break into your car and steal your radio. You know, I remember seeing people that had detachable steering wheels, which is something that I loved, you know, that you could take your steering wheel with you so that it would make, you know, your car harder to steal. You know, it was just, you know, devastating. And even more, you saw the human toll. So because you saw, you know, friends and relatives and mothers and fathers, you know, become hooked on crack and many, you know, never really came out of it. You know, that either died or were sent to jail or are still living lives that were devastated by this drug.
That's what was so powerful about the film, is to meet former dealers and users who talk about their experience and then talk about how they're still dealing with the aftermath of this epidemic. How are you able to find so many of these people, and what was that experience like to, you know, get them to share so many personal details of their lives?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we really wanted to do going into the film is to make this tragedy human, you know, to put a human face on it and to talk to people who got caught up in using drugs and also caught up in dealing drugs. You know, one of the people that was instrumental is a guy named Samson Stiles, who we interview in the film. And he was a drug dealer. And he talks, you know, very openly about, you know, having a job at McDonald's and, you know, I think it was $3.50 an hour, and then taxes were taken out. And he was in high school and his girlfriend had a baby on the way and he just wasn't making enough money. And friend comes along and says, you know, gives him some crack vials to sell. And as he put it, you know, in 20 minutes, he had sold 100 vials. And he was like, yeah, this is where I can make some real money. As he calls it, a gold rush, you know, for the hood. Mm-hmm. You know, he was also great because he now has reformed, as so many of the people that we interview has done. And he has kept in contact with many people. And so he helped us find people to interview. But he ended up, you know, getting shot 5 or 6 times. He ended up, you know, going to jail for 2 long bits. So, you know, people didn't come out of it unscathed. But we really wanted to have you know, personal stories and to put a human face on these people, not only people who were using drugs, but people who were dealing drugs.
And to also remind people of what was happening at that time. In the film, historian Elizabeth Hinton reminds us that during the Reagan administration, 500,000 people were eliminated from the welfare rolls. 2.6 million children were taken off of lunch programs. And unemployment was at a record high in 1982. For so many of these people, like Samson Stiles, there were no opportunities. Work at McDonald's, get a job that paid $3.50 an hour.
Right. I mean, you know, we start the film with this incredible clip where Ronald Reagan accepts the nomination, you know, from the Republican Party. And he says, you know, he's going to make America great again. Mm. You know, so it's such an echo, you know, to our times. I mean, he uses that phrase. But, you know, again, as you mentioned, we go into the fact that, you know, that it's record unemployment and, you know, welfare lines are growing. There's no jobs, especially, you know, in inner cities. And, you know, crack, as Samson says, you know, looked like it was a gold rush for the hood. And also, you know, the thing that's really important to realize is that one of the things that was happening, and it seems so strange today, is that there was no policing at first. You know,
right.
that crack, that people were allowed to sell crack. You know, you didn't have to, you know, be Sherlock Holmes or something to find where people were selling crack. You just walk out your door. And people were lined up in cars or lined up in the streets and, you know, smoking crack on the streets. And, you know, we have many clips of people, you know, dealing crack, with people lined up, you know, in cars to buy crack, honking their horns, you know, to get people to hurry up and buy their crack ahead of them so they could move up on the line. It was just crazy. And I think that, you know, for so many people who are around, the film is a reminder of what was going on. But one of the things that we found is that young people who don't remember that are just really fascinated by the film. You know, I have a 30-year-old daughter and 21-year-old twins, and it's the first time in my life that their friends have texted me, you know, because they've watched the film and they're like, "What?" You know, like you just can't believe it. And you know, it's not that we only talk about it, but you see it and we show it.
What do the young people say? What didn't they know? What aspects did they know?
Yeah, I mean, they had heard the term, but they didn't kind of understand the progression of it. They didn't understand that it was everywhere. You know, that it was right out in the open. That people were buying crack out in the open, you know, smoking crack out in the open. You know, we have footage of deals, you know, of people making crack deals, and the people, you know, look really good. You know, they're coming up in suits and ties and buying crack. I mean, so it's not only the stereotypical crackhead, but, you know, but so many other people that were caught up in it.
Well, and to that point, it's important to point out, Elizabeth Hinton, again, a historian, says that the majority of crack users were actually white. I mean, this was later, once police really went off in these neighborhoods, but she points out that police specifically targeted people of color.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they targeted people of color, and also it was because it was easier, because crack was sold out in the open, because they let it be sold out in the open in Black and Latinx communities. So, you know, it was prevalent in the communities because they let it be that way, and it was so easy to say now we're going to move in. And that's really what happened. You know, now we're going to move in. Now we're going to crack down on these evil crack dealers. And they were right out in the open in the communities, again, because they let it be out in the open.
Well, let's play a clip. This is a clip from the new Netflix documentary, Crack, Cocaine, Corruption, and Conspiracy. And these are people talking about how they were affected by crack.
In the Bible, they talk about the locusts coming and converging on all the wheat and taking and killing all the crops. Crack devastated our community.
crack was like a virus. As if something was in the air.
Yo, I used to sell crack myself.
It changed the entire culture.
This is crack.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
The blocks were all decimated. Now there's trash everywhere.
It looked like a scene from a George Romero film. Night of the Living Dead.
How many do you want?
Yeah, you crack.
Crack changed my whole personality. It made me don't care about people.
I saw myself going down more and more, but I wouldn't and I couldn't stop.
I start losing weight. My waist getting skinny, my shirt's getting too big.
How many cracks you need?
25. Some of us tried to hide it at first, but when it got worse, we didn't care who saw us.
What you need?
What's up, man?
I ain't been home in 4 days. Ain't got no sleep in 4 days. I've been eating. Man, 95 pounds.
Your kids?
Yeah. I got one. 11.
11-year-old?
Mm-hmm. Boy.
Where is he?
With my mother.
Last time you saw him?
A year and a half ago.
What's his name?
Angelo.
You miss him?
Yes, I do.
That drug separated people from themselves. And in so doing, separated them from their families. And it felt like the range of the drug in terms of its impact was wider on women.
That is a clip from the new Netflix documentary Crack, Cocaine, Corruption, and Conspiracy. And we're joined today by Stanley Nelson, Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker. Stanley, the first voice we heard in that clip is Susan Burton, an amazing woman who was on our show, I think it was last year, or the year before. Susan is a former user. She had a son who was 5 years old. He was killed. As she says that her grief and her rage consumed her and crack helped her escape. And she actually wrote a book about her entire experience becoming Miss Burton, from prison to recovery to leading the fight for incarcerated women. Tell us more about Susan. What really stood out for you when you interviewed her?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Susan's just one of those incredible people that, you know, really was caught up in crack. I think she was arrested 5 or 6 times. But she has, when we made the film, she was 21 years clean. And she just, you know, incorporates so much of a journey through crack. You know, she was a mother, and as you say, her son was killed, and through her grief, she started using crack and just, you know, went downhill until she was arrested over and over again. But always arrested for possession. You know, never arrested for dealing, never arrested for committing a crime other than having crack on her person. And as she says, you know, so beautifully in the film, you know, that she was never offered treatment. You know, she was just put in jail over and over again. And, you know, she said, you know, anybody could see that I had a drug problem. You know, not a criminal problem. I had a drug problem. But she's never offered a treatment because that wasn't, you know, what was being offered. You know, it was being, you know, what was offered was just say no. And the ridiculousness of that as a drug policy, you know, okay, this is our drug policy, just say no, you know, and in prison, you know, and those were the two things that were offered.
Susan asks a key question in the film about why this happened. Why did crack decimate these communities? Here's another clip from the film Crack, Cocaine, Corruption, and Conspiracy.
Why was our community saturated with such a devastating chemical? I've heard of chemical warfare, and that was kind of like chemical warfare on black communities. Where did it come from? And most of all, why?
And that is a clip from the new Netflix documentary Crack, Cocaine, Corruption, and Conspiracy. Stanley, how did you all decide to tackle that question? where did it come from and why? You've got really an amazing section about what happened with the United States helping to fight the Sandinista dictatorship of Nicaragua and supplying rebel groups, the Contras, with financial and military support. And we can talk about that. Peter Kornbluth, you interview a senior analyst for the National Security Archive, says Ronald Reagan and his administration allowed drugs to pour into the United States from Central America. He said, quote, "Our goal was to defeat communism. If that meant drugs got in and the youth of America used them, well, that was the way it was going to be." So can you just talk about the process involved and how you all tackled that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think from the very beginning, we knew that that was the story. You know, the story was, you know, at the bottom level was somebody just buying cocaine crack cocaine on the street. You know, that you know, like Susan Burton, that was at the bottom. But the story went all the way up through dealers and the police, and et cetera, until it was at the federal government level. You know, who was, you know, letting cocaine come into the country at the very least, and at the worst, you know, helping to smuggle cocaine into the country. So we knew, you know, that was one of the things that really attracted us to the story, that it was on so many different levels, you know, and it was really complicated to kind of unpack the story, and especially with the government piece of the story, you know, what we could say, and what we couldn't say, you know, that was very important. You know, it's very important for me and the films that we make that we're totally accurate, because so many people are gonna be like, "What?" You know, like, wait a minute, are you saying the federal government was involved? And you know, so we had to be very clear about, you know, the involvement of the federal government and what we could say about that, and what we couldn't say.
Well, you're right. And that's why that clip from Peter Kornbluth is so powerful. I mean, a man who used to work for the National Security Archive saying that, you know, if you want to, you're going to defeat communism and Marxists. And if you get drugs into these communities, well, so be it. I mean, that's exactly what he said.
Yeah, I mean, and that was kind of the federal government's you know, stance on it. You know, you know, certain things have to be sacrificed. I'm sorry, have to be sacrificed in the war on drugs. And if we sacrifice, you know, black and brown communities, you know, okay, you know, that's kind of that's not our concern exactly.
Right. It also is connected to the great job you all did looking at just how the legislation changed over the years from Ronald Reagan to Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan to George H.W. Bush, and then to Bill Clinton, and how you had Ronald Reagan starting, you know, the Just Say No campaign, George W. Bush coming into office vowing to crack down even harder. After a break, we can go into more detail. And then Clinton having to be even tougher. So what really struck you about the interviews you did about how things changed over those administrations?
I think what really struck me is how things changed and how things didn't change. You know, that it was really important that, you know, through these different administrations and different men, that really it just got worse and worse. You know, that Bill Clinton was not a savior. You know, oh, finally we have a Democratic president, but everybody, you know, it just got worse and worse. You know, more and more Jenkinsian sentences. You know, that everybody felt that we had to fight the war on drugs, and the only thing that you couldn't be is soft. You can't be soft on drugs. So the policies just got worse and worse and worse.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Stanley Nelson is an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker and founder of Firelight Media, a nonprofit production company. His latest documentary is Crack, Cocaine, Corruption, and Conspiracy. And you can see it now on Netflix. It exposes how the crack epidemic decimated black and brown communities. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are speaking with Stanley Nelson, an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker. His latest documentary is called Crack, Cocaine, Corruption, and Conspiracy. He looks back on how the crack epidemic of the 80s decimated black and brown communities and fueled racial and economic inequality, hyper-aggressive policing, mass incarceration, and government corruption. And you can see the film now on Netflix. Stanley, let's dig into just the laws that have been passed over the past couple of decades to really explore how we got to this point. Since 1980, the prison population was 300,000. More than 2 million people are behind bars today. And the fastest growing segment of the population are women. And so in 1986, as people pointed out in the film, members of the House are up for re-election, and the war on drugs is an opportunity for them to really talk about how tough they were. And Tip O'Neill, a Democrat from Massachusetts, said drug dealers should be sentenced to life. He wanted mandatory minimums. He wanted this bill done in 4 weeks, which never happens. But because Republicans and Democrats were on board, boom, it happened. And all of a sudden you had the Anti-Drug Abuse Act, the most unjust federal law ever written, according to people that you interviewed in the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the hysteria rises against crack when finally, you know, the law enforcement and politicians recognize, you know, that something is happening. And crazy laws are passed, you know, very quickly. And so, you know, 5 grams of crack cocaine gets you a mandatory sentence, the same sentence as 500 grams of powder cocaine. And just so, you know, people understand, you know, a gram of coke is like a sugar packet. So if you think about 5 grams of crack, it's like 5 sugar packets that could fit in your back pocket. And, it, you know, and so it's not like you're a dealer. And you know, the people were getting huge sentences, mandatory sentences for a little bit of crack. And you know, we have this incredible interview with Charles Rangel, the longtime congressman from Harlem, you know, in New York, who says, you know, for a camera, you know, that the best thing that he could say was that it seemed like a good idea at the time. Hmm. You know, and that's really a telling statement. So you now have this incredibly unjust law and police crackdown, and anybody that's caught with crack, whether you're a dealer or just a user, you know, gets put in jail for mandatory sentences.
And then you have George H.W. Bush coming into office, vowing to crack down on the epidemic. I don't want to give this part away. I hope everyone can see this. But in his first national address, he showed crack cocaine seized in front of the White House. And there's a really incredible and important story behind that. And then you have Bill Clinton inaugurated. And in 1994, he said, we'll put 100,000 police officers on the streets, which is a 20% increase, and tens of millions of dollars went to militarizing police forces. Stanley, it's also amazing just to see how policing really changed. As you said in the beginning, there was really no policing. And then you interviewed another former dealer, Corey Peaks?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he talked about how he got busted in a park. And the cops pulled him over and said, tell your boy I'm taking care of you. And that's when he learned that cops were actually being paid off.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that we make a real case for, in lots of instances, the police being part of it. Mm-hmm. You know, we have footage from drug commissions where, you know, cops talk about the fact that, you know, they would bust people. And you know, if you bust somebody, you know, you could easily just take their drugs or take their money and let them go, you know, or put them in jail. And so, you know, the police had a lot of power over people's lives. But also, you know, obviously, you know, we show footage of this that the crack was sold openly, you know, on the streets. And you know, you really, if you weren't there, you have to see it to believe it. But, you know, I was in New York City and I was coming home from a party or something, you know, taking a cab at 2 or 3 in the morning and passing one street in Harlem, and it looked like broad daylight. I mean, there were like hundreds of people out on the street, you know, just in the crack economy. Again, it you know, you didn't have to do detective work to find it, but the police let it go. And you know, were paid off or didn't want to, as other people say in the film, you know, or just didn't want to be bothered, you know, and that that was how it was.
So you had these laws really change that. And then another very important moment in all of this is the murder of a police officer. And right when that happened, you just saw police going in these communities and arresting people en masse.
Yeah, and you see that in footage. You know, Samson talks about, you know, getting arrested. You know, other people talk about getting arrested. That it changed. You know, all of a sudden, you know, as the police officer gets killed, they crack down all over the country, and you know, we're just in the mass arrests. You see, you know, 10, 20 people lined up against the wall, you know, all in handcuffs, just being arrested. And again, you know, getting long jail terms for that. And you know, we continue to see it till today. I mean, that, it, you know, as you said, it goes from, what, say, 300,000 people in jail to 2 million, over 2 million. That's a kind of one of the ways we got here. Mm.
Today we're speaking with Stanley Nelson, an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker. His latest documentary is called Crack, Cocaine, Corruption, and Conspiracy. It is on Netflix. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Z in San Francisco. Hi, Z. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I live in a south of Market and in a building that probably has maybe 30% of the people that are even elderly that are still addicted to crack and go out twice a day to buy crack cocaine. In the neighborhood, it seems like in the Tenderloin and also south of Market, there is a predominance of Honduran crack dealers from the East Bay that have taken over the city of San Francisco for crack dealing and other dealing, and they come every night, and we call and call, but you know, it's the business is there. And you know, people in my building, I believe, have probably smoked crack since crack was invented. Mm-hmm. And they're still smoking crack, and it's amazing that they can still be alive and continue, but it's an everyday thing. I see it all the time in South of Market. Low-income housing is a magnet for people who are addicts.
Well, thank you for the call. And Stanley, this brings up a larger question about where we are today. You know, here in San Francisco, I was just searching for some numbers, and I mean, we've got fentanyl causing people to overdose in San Francisco. I'm just reading from, here's one, December 2020, 58 more people died of drug overdoses in November 2020. January 2021, San Francisco sees record overdose deaths from fentanyl. What are your thoughts about where we are right now in this conversation about trying to get people help and addressing this in a very different way? I mean, it's fascinating when you look at the opioid epidemic. That started out as a public health crisis, even though a lot of people are still not getting the help that they need. But it was framed very differently. So what are your thoughts on these bigger questions?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you know, again, it's framed very differently today. You know, look, the policy, you know, that we have towards opiate users is not enlightened. You know, it's not a great policy, but at least it is being talked about as a health crisis, as a health problem, where, you know, crack was not. So I think we have a long way to go. You know, still people who are addicted to drugs are thought of in many ways as, you know, the throwaways of society. And that, you know, there's not much that we can do, but it's a lot better than it was during the crack era, where there was nothing. And we laughed in some ways and joked about crackheads and crack mamas. And, you know, you see comedians, you know, do sketches about people, you know, on crack. At least I think it's thought of a little bit different, but I wouldn't say it's a really hugely enlightened way that we think about opioid users today.
And there's a huge push by some to allow for safe drug sites. This has been happening in San Francisco and Oakland. What are your thoughts about this? I'm just reading now from the San Francisco Chronicle. The push to open the sites comes as San Francisco experienced a 70% increase in overdose deaths last year. That is a huge increase.
Yeah, I think that, you know, fentanyl, you know, is just an incredibly powerful drug, you know, and that, I don't want to be a drug expert or pretend right. like, you know, I'm an expert on drugs, but I think that, you know, the more that we try to take a health approach, the more that we try to, you know, understand drugs, the better. Yeah. You know, the ones I've done a couple of, you know, films on drugs, and you know, the one thing that you can't even say, you know, to so many, you know, people in the United States or drug policy people is the fact that, you know, for the short term, drugs make you feel good. You know, and so, you know, let's start from there. That people aren't crazy, you know, for using drugs, and that we've got to think about, you know, drug use in a real way. So I think we're just so far away from that, you know, as a country.
Right. Well, thank you for the call, Z. And we will definitely do a show about what is happening in San Francisco and the Bay Area. I've also been really wanting to do a show about Portugal, which became the first country in the world to decriminalize the consumption of all drugs. As far as I know, based on what I've read, they have really incredible drug treatment programs. So we will definitely continue to do shows about this. I also want to play a clip that's related. We talked a bit about this earlier, but these are people in the film who just talked about why there was no help. The clip starts with Susan Burton, who we talked about earlier, a former user. Tanya Taylor, a former dealer who was shot in her back about an inch or two from her spine and almost died. Samson Stiles, a former dealer. And Asethia Lulu Pierce, a former user who was a working, loving mom. The drug really ruined her life. She said she lost everything, her apartment, her daughters had to be taken away from her. And here is a clip from the new documentary, Crack, Cocaine, Corruption, and Conspiracy.
I was sentenced to prison 6 different times. You would have thought someone would have said that you don't have a criminal problem. You have an alcohol or a drug problem. And there's help for that. But I was never offered any help. And I read the papers today. And I look at the approach to opioid use. And you hear about a health approach, not a criminal approach. I'm 21 years sober now. Wasn't I worth an investment in treatment? I'm sorry.
For the past 20-some years, I've been living with PTSD. It really started once I got shot. And every now and again, you know, I might have a bipolar episode, mood swings here and there. I have anxiety, you know. So, I mean, these are things that I have to deal with because of the choices that I made. Yep.
I was shot in 1988, 5 times. I went away for 3 years. I got locked up for gun possession and drug possession. I really lost myself. I have plenty of regrets for the role I played in the crack era. I lost a lot of friends. A lot of friends, almost all of them.
I lost my job. I lost my home. It made me lose everything. Everything. And I got to the point where I didn't care no more. Especially after I asked my sister to take my girls. It changed me from the person that I was to where I'm at now.
That is a clip from Stanley Nelson's latest documentary, Crack, Cocaine, Corruption, and Conspiracy. Stanley, that line from Susan, I think, says so much. Wasn't I worth an investment in treatment?
Yeah, I think that, that just echoes. One of the things we wanted to do in the clip that we just heard was bring it back to the human level, you know, so we start at the human level and then we kind of build to, you know, the international conspiracy. And then we wanted to bring it back to the human level, to the devastation, to the fact that these people, weren't untouched by, the epidemic and, what happened.
You know, watching the film and thinking about where we are today in terms of racism, stereotypes, assumptions, I think what the section about the women really was so striking, and how the media really created hysteria and fueled a false narrative about, quote, crack babies, kids who were born with a level of crack in their system. And this was based on an article by Ira Chasna, a pediatrician whose research was based on 23 babies. This turned out to be completely false, but it put such a target on black moms and this whole idea that pop culture really picked on, and I hate to even say this, but this is what they picked up on. Black women love crack more than they love their children. And this is with us to this day in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's very striking. You know, we use a hip-hop song from the era, you know, with video. Your mama's on crack rock, you know. We use clips from movies, about women on crack. It's just, kind of overwhelming. You know, one of the stories that we tell is of a woman, and she's in the film, who was arrested, one of the first person who was arrested for dealing crack to her unborn fetus. And what they charged was that in the 30 seconds when the baby is born, and before the umbilical cord is cut, that she's dealing crack through her body, through the umbilical cord, to her baby. And she gets arrested for that.
That was incredible. And then to also see the nurse asking questions about substance abuse problems and saying she just needed the information. But what this person was doing, this woman was doing, was turning that information over to police. I mean, that footage was just shocking to see.
Yeah, it's amazing. And the woman who was actually arrested for dealing crack to her unborn baby, the way that she ended up in the hospital and that they ended up watching her to do that is she told her doctor that she had a drug problem. because she was scared, you know, for her fetus, for her baby. She told her doctor that she had a drug problem, and her doctor calls the police and they arrest her.
And her name was Jennifer Johnson.
Yeah.
Right. Let's take a few more calls. Let's go to Nick in Oakland. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much. This question has to do with connecting the dots back to the civil rights movement and the efforts to systematically undermine and destroy the Black Power movement that was happening, the civil rights movement. And I just have a hard time believing that the effort to disempower the black, those Black Power movements was not related to the proliferation of drugs in those neighborhoods, as opposed to just simply a collateral damage related to the, you know, fight against communism. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Great question. Thank you, Nick. What are your thoughts, Stanley?
I think one of the interesting things, you know, I mean, I can't prove anything. So, but, you know, we made a film called Black Panther's Vanguard of the Revolution. And, you know, it's the story of the Black Panther Party. And when you look at the Black Panther Party, you know, which is what started in Oakland, California, and you look at, you know, the Black Panthers and you know, the Black people marching and protesting, you know, in 1966, they look so strong, you know, and so determined and so healthy, you know, and then, you know, heroin really flooded into the Black communities and they changed, you know, and, you know, I can't, you know, we can't prove, you know, what happened, but it certainly, drugs, the influx of drugs that happened, you know, in the you know, late 60s, early 70s, it really changed the Black and brown communities.
Mm. Yeah, well, thank you for that question. It's something that I think we should explore because when you do connect the dots, it's hard not to come up with that assessment and conclusion. But we'll definitely bring some guests on in the coming weeks or months to talk about that. Thank you so much for calling, Nick. Let's go next to Gary in Greenbrae. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, hi. Thank you very much. And I really appreciate this program. I'm looking forward to watching the video. But I'm old enough that I was in San Francisco in the era when Gary Webb's Dark Alliance series appeared in San Jose Mercury News, and I knew him personally. And I told him, I said, Gary, you know, you're going to be destroyed by your fellow journalists. And that's exactly what happened. Not long after his articles came out, an article by Kim Wiener came out. The Los Angeles Times put 20 journalists on the job of trying to destroy Gary Webb's stories. He ultimately ended up committing suicide after the San Jose Mercury News essentially demoted him and moved him 90 miles from his family. This is what happens when word gets out, I think, that you know, and the government stands with the drug dealers. Good personal friends, Jonathan Marshall and Peter Dale Scott, the author of Cocaine Politics, Alfred McCoy, the author
Gary, sorry to cut you off, but we are almost out of time, and I want to be sure to have time for Stanley to comment. We're actually getting a lot of emails about Gary Webb, who sadly died by suicide. What are your thoughts on this? I believe that you show one of Gary Webb's newspaper articles in the film, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. We kind of avoided the Gary Webb story because it's a very complicated one. And you know, Gary Webb was the first person to really tie the involvement of the federal government to crack, and especially crack on the West Coast. But it's a very complicated story. I think there's been a film or two about Gary Webb. You know, it takes probably a whole film to unpack all of it, but certainly his reporting was really important and really influential in unpacking the whole idea of the federal government being involved. I wish that we could have done more with the Gary Webb story, but it again is a long, complicated story. In that, we felt good because there have been other films that really deal with Gary Webb.
Right. Final thoughts, Stanley. At a time when so many people are calling for major reform with Black Lives Matter. We've actually already seen change. There's more progressive public defenders in many cities across the country. What are your takeaways? I mean, one of the things that you've said in past interviews is that we have to expose the truth about the past in order to change current policies.
And then we have to keep exposing the truth and keep pushing. I think that's all that we all can do. I think that George Floyd's death and the push for change there was a piece of the puzzle. But I don't think we can ever stop and say that things are we've gotten there. When Obama was elected, we wanted to sit back and think, oh, okay. Okay, now we've made a big change, and 8 years later, Trump's elected. Mm-hmm. So I think that every success is just a reason to push more and push more for change and more understanding and equality in this country.
Well, Stanley Nelson, thank you so much for this great film, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for the ability to talk about this film.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.